The streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder.
Well, folks, we have another roundtable for you today. And we have three excellent guests with opinions all across the spectrum. And we're going to look at some broad issues that were raised by the case of Stanley Liggins versus the state of Iowa. This is a little bit different than what we usually do. We usually get down to the nitty-gritty and looking at specifics of the case. In this case, we're going to look at broad issues raised by the case. Some of the issues that we'll look at are the exclusionary rule, which blocks certain types of evidence from being presented in court if the court finds that they are obtained illegally by the police. We're going to look at the issue of how much prior bad acts should be allowed into evidence against a suspect when they're being tried in a case like this. And we're also going to look at the death penalty. So it's going to be a variety of issues. We have three excellent guests here, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what they have to say. The first person we have here is Lauren Myerskoff Mueller, and she is part of the Illinois Innocence Project, and she can probably find a little bit more background about her work as a defense attorney and maybe give 2 minutes about what the Illinois Innocence Project is all about.
Sure. So I graduated from Northwestern Law School, and when I was going to school there, I did several clinics with their Bloom Legal Clinic there and worked on some wrongful conviction cases through that. And I also worked for a couple years with the Cook County Public Defender Side Task Force, working on murder cases there. And then after I graduated, I was a public defender in Lake County before I joined the Illinois Innocence Project, where we look at cases of actual innocence in Illinois, where people are claiming that they were not involved with the crime and have been wrongfully convicted. And we look through their case, evaluate it to see if it's a good case for actual innocence, based on what we understand about wrongful convictions and the causes of wrongful convictions. A lot of our cases are funded through federal grants that require DNA testing, which is the type of grant I'm working under, a Bloodsworth grant, and I'm looking into specifically guilty plea cases and some Latino cases.
Okay. Kathleen Barber is writing a novel right now, and she happens to hail from my hometown of Galesburg, Illinois. Kathleen, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've written?
Yeah, thanks. So actually, like Lauren, I also went to Northwestern Law. When I graduated, I was doing corporate restructuring work, though, and I no longer practice because, as Scott mentioned, I wrote a novel. It's coming out in August this year from Gallery Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And the reason that this is probably interesting to this audience is because my book, Are You Sleeping?, is a suspense novel that's kind of centered around a serial-style podcast that's reinvestigating a long-closed murder case. So in the book, the protagonist's father was killed 13 years ago, and the neighbor boy was arrested and convicted of his murder, largely on the strength of the protagonist's sister's testimony that she saw him pull the trigger. But he has always maintained his innocence, and then this investigative reporter gets involved and creates this podcast kind of as a complement to our investigation. And the podcast becomes this, like, runaway smash hit. And the book, then, is about the impact that this has on, like, the protagonist and her family. So the podcast has like a lot of fans that are like seeking the family out. And her sister is having her testimony and her character questioned. And it's just really painful for all of them to like have this tragedy brought up all over again. Kind of like not to mention the fact that the protagonist feels like her family's tragedy is kind of being commodified for entertainment value. So that's what the book is about. I do want to note, though, that the podcast in the book is much more salacious than Scott's podcast or Serial, which I think are both like excellent. Whereas the podcast in my book is more like tabloid style journalism.
And Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization?
Criminal Justice Legal Foundation is a national think tank and public interest law foundation focused on criminal cases that go before the U.S. Supreme Court. We do some appellate court work, but rarely do some state work, but our primary focus is on cases going to the Supreme Court. Our objective is to make sure the court acknowledges the rights of crime victims and the tools law enforcement needs to enforce the law.
I didn't mention your last name when we spoke. It's Michael Rushford. And you're president and CEO of, what's the organization?
It's called the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation.
Okay. And what was your background before you founded the organization?
I lobbied for law enforcement issues for the California Chamber of Commerce for 5 years. We wrote some criminal law at that time, managed to get some initiatives passed to reduce crime in California, and did some work to advise the public as to crime problems and how to deal with them.
Well, we actually had a little bit of news committed today, so I'm going to read you something that was filed with the court today. It's a letter from Stanley Liggins to Judge Grieve, and here's what he had to say. Dear Judge Grieve, I am so sorry for writing another letter to you. I'm in a position that calls for it. I sent Mr. Jones a letter today firing him. I no longer want or need him as my attorney. The trust is no longer there. I do not believe anything he say. I know he's been telling untruths for some time now. The reports I wrote you about last month that Mr. Jones didn't return to me are very important to my case. I expect the cops and the county attorney to hide and keep information from me, but not my lawyers. Mr. Jones comes to see me last Friday, and I was told he could do anything he wanted, and I have no say so. And he could care less about me writing you about it. This new evidence I'm talking about is not part of the 77 that was not turned over. I just received this since being in jail. I'm asking for a hearing. If need be, I'll file the motion myself. If Mr. Jones does not, it's up to him. I've wasted enough time with this guy. This didn't start until Phil got cancer. I tried my best to work this out, and Phil has been working with me to do so. It's done and over with. If I don't hear from him in their office this week, I'll file myself. Thank you, Stanley Liggins. Just for background, the Phil he refers to in this letter is Phil Ramirez, who is his former lawyer with the Public Defender's Office. Derek Jones is Phil's assistant. Phil was diagnosed with cancer and had to withdraw from the case, and Derek Jones took it over along with Miguel Puentes. And I guess I'll start out here with Lauren, since she's been a public defender. Have you run across things like this where defendants decide to fire their public defender weeks before the trial?
Yes, I have seen that happen before in court where and also read transcripts about it where the defendant is attempting to get new counsel or fire their current counsel. And honestly, what in my experience, what tends to happen is the judge denies that, especially when it's very close to the start of the trial, because it would take so long for someone to get up to speed on the case at that point. And also what judges usually say in these rulings is that you do have the right to counsel if you're indigent, you know, you have the right to an appointed counsel, but you don't have the right to any counsel in the world that you want. It's who you get appointed. So you don't get to choose who in the office you have, unless obviously there's some egregious issue that's going on. But a lot of the strategy is up to defense counsel. The big picture questions are up to the defendant, bench versus jury trial, if the defendant testifies or not. But defense strategy is typically left up to the defense counsel.
One of the things that struck me is in Mr. Jones's filing last week with the court, he has said essentially the same thing, much more in a legalese sort of language. But one of the things he said was, there's nobody else in the public defender's office that can handle this case. If I don't do it, it has to be assigned to somebody in private practice because we have limited resources here. And I guess the question that comes to mind, is that a reasonable expectation for the court to hire somebody in private practice? Michael, what's your thoughts here?
It is reasonable, and I can tell you that it wasn't that long ago when the American Bar Association congratulated and gave tribute to attorneys who stepped out of their private practice, even civil practice, and took criminal cases, even capital cases. So it is not a surprise. Now, obviously, the best defense attorney you could get would be an ex-prosecutor, in my mind, because they know both sides. And a lot of former prosecutors do criminal defense later in their careers. But I think while criminal law is different than civil law, everybody puts their pants on the same way, and you can learn it. And we've seen some excellent defenses presented by attorneys who didn't spend their whole time doing capital cases or criminal cases and still did an excellent job. The idea that defendants are unhappy with their defense attorneys, I hate to tell you this is not breaking news. Almost every time you lose, your defense attorney was at fault.
They perceive that their defense attorney was at fault.
Of course. And if you've got 20 years to review your case and have other attorneys come in and review your case, you can find things that perhaps the a judge somewhere down the line on your third habeas corpus petition would say, well, that might be a problem. That might have swayed the jury. The Supreme Court took a capital case today out of Texas where an illegal strangled a woman to death during a home burglary back in 1995. And his defense attorney did not present to the sentencing jury the fact that this gang member liked to sniff cocaine. And that might have had an impact on the jury's decision to sentence him to death. The Supreme Court took the case. In my mind, it's absolutely, there's no question of guilt here. He doesn't claim he didn't do it. So now the Supreme Court is going to review the claim that a gang member might have sniffed cocaine before he strangled a 67-year-old woman to death. And that might be something that would overturn his sentence.
Do you have anything you'd like to add here, Katie? I know your background is more bankruptcy law, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. My background's in bankruptcy law, so I don't have a lot of knowledge about public defense. I certainly feel for Mr. Liggins, though, if he feels as though, you know, after all these years, he's finally getting another trial, and then he's unhappy with the strategy. If I were him, I would probably want to continue having an attorney, but that's kind of up to him.
There's a lot of issues that were raised in this case that are really broad global issues within the criminal justice community altogether. One of the things that struck me, and we haven't talked a lot about this in previous episodes, but there was a search done 27 years ago of Stanley Liggins' hotel room in Rock Island. It's as we have said in a previous episode, it was a pretty rough-looking place where he was staying. He did a consensual search, meaning that when he was interrogated by the Davenport, Iowa police, they got him to sign a waiver allowing him to search the room. He contends that the police assured him that they would only look for things related to Jennifer's case. They would not concern themselves with any other illegal material they would find in the room. That's his contention. The former prosecutor in the case, Bill Davis, also has said something to the effect of, the police may well have said that. They are allowed under Supreme Court rules to lie during interrogations. That's not, I think the word he said, it's not fair, but it's legal. The case, when they searched the room, they found trace amounts of cocaine in the hotel room. And he was charged under Illinois law with possession of cocaine. It went before an Illinois judge, and the Illinois judge ruled it was inadmissible because he thought it was an illegal search. And the interesting thing is, since they obviously threw out the search, they had to throw out the drug case against Danny Liggins. Interestingly enough, the same search turned up some other things in the room, like birthday presents for a young girl. Jennifer's birthday was that week, obviously, but also coming up was a birthday for the daughter of Stanley's girlfriend at the time. We found a stun, I guess we call it a stun gun or a taser type of device was there, and some other things. What's interesting to me is when it came into whether it was admissible in court in Iowa for the murder case, an Iowa judge said it was a perfectly legal search and allowed the information in. And as I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, hey, how can this be? You have the same search being conducted, and one state, Illinois, says, no, this is an illegal search, and they rule it's inadmissible. Iowa, on the other hand, looks at the same set of facts, and they say, no, this is perfectly admissible. This can be allowed in. Obviously, judges can have different opinions, but one of the things that came to my mind is the whole issue of the exclusionary rule, which says the fruits of an improper search can't be used in a court of law. Michael, why don't I start out with you? What's your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously, this is something that's probably an important issue among the law enforcement community.
Well, at the trial level, you can find judges with a pretty broad variety of opinions as to what constitutes a legal search, how much discretion the law enforcement officer can have, and what is admissible. And these kinds of cases probably make up about 20% of the appellate docket around the country. There is some division among federal courts of appeal if you go all the way up on these kinds of cases. The Supreme Court has laid down some pretty good lines in recent decisions giving officers more discretion, but you can still have a problem in the first two levels of appeal, or at the trial in the first level of appeal, if you've got a warrant for a search and you find things that aren't listed in the warrant. That's a pretty good claim the defense can make at trial, and depending on how up the trial judge is on current law, he may say, we're going to exclude that because it wasn't listed specifically in the warrant, although there's some evidence of criminal intent here. Other judges might let it in. So there's a lot of play in the bones with regard to the Fourth Amendment, and that's kind of why you've got the courts of appeal, and it's kind of why we're in this business, is because we try and make it as clear for the officer as possible what he's allowed and not allowed to do, because every time you've got a mistake like this, even a small one, where a word is left out of a warrant, you can end up with an appeal that can overturn or prevent evidence from going into a trial.
I guess I'm going to ask you in a more broad sense, should there be an exclusionary rule?
No.
Okay, tell me
why.
In
my opinion, I think that legitimate evidence, which means real evidence, the gun, DNA, the stolen goods, what have you, there wasn't an exclusionary rule in the Constitution. It wasn't in the common law. If it was evidence either way, for or against the defendant, it was admissible. And the courts have created this rule and monkeyed with it for a long time, and it has become, during different times of our history, a huge sieve that filtered out some cases where the defendant was absolutely guilty, even of crimes of murder. But because the officer blundered, the evidence was restricted from the jury. And we always thought, at least initially, that the jury needed to see as much as it could. you got the best verdict when the jury got to see all the legitimate evidence available to make the determination. So we've had a problem with it. We've won a lot of cases to narrow the exclusionary rule or to give police officers good faith exceptions. And that's the best we're going to get because it's been in the law for quite a while.
Okay. Lauren, I have a feeling that you have some strong opinions on this.
I do. I strongly disagree. I think there should be an exclusionary rule. The Constitution does protect our privacy. There's a constitutional right against unreasonable searches and seizures. It's in the Fourth Amendment that I believe, and also the idea of a right to privacy has been read into the Constitution beyond that. But we don't live in a police state where police officers can do anything they want and just go in without any reason, without a warrant, without being invited in, and just look for things. That's not the America that was formed with the Constitution and not one that we live in today. And I believe that when there are bad searches, that's a threat to everyone, to our constitutional rights across the board. And I don't think that the fruits of those searches should be able to be used in court because that threatens everyone's rights. And if you do hold police to a high standard of what they're allowed to do and what they need to do in order to get this evidence that they want and that they need, I think that that creates a better, more reliable system in general. And I don't necessarily even believe in the good faith exception. I understand it. I just find it hard to believe in many cases that good faith existed. I think a lot of people know what they're doing when they go into these houses with these search warrants that are too vague, or they know they're supposed to be looking for one thing and they collect all of these other things. I think that the exclusionary rule at this point has been narrowed too much. But I do find it, going back to this case, interesting what happened in Illinois versus Iowa. And I don't know if it was just a consent form that was signed and what the exact language was versus a warrant, because then it does differ. I know that search warrants can be very, very tailored to looking specifically for a weapon or specifically for drugs or evidence of a particular crime. And you're not allowed to then take into evidence other items that could be evidence of other crimes. But I'm not exactly, I haven't seen those documents in this case, so I can't really say.
Not alone. We haven't seen them either. The Davenport police have not turned over a lot of the documents that we requested. We do know that it was a consent form that was signed. We don't know the specific language of the form. That's still out there. I look forward to when this case is over, when we can hopefully get a hold of those sort of documents. But Kathleen, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I mostly agree with Lauren. I understand the concern that if evidence is getting thrown out because of like an honest mistake, that like a guilty person is going to go free, and that could be like a travesty. But I think it's more important to be protecting people's Fourth Amendment rights, particularly when you're dealing with people who might not necessarily know their own rights, or that are perhaps unsophisticated when it comes to the law. I don't think it's fair for people to get in situations like Mr. Liggins did, where he believed that he was consenting to a search for one thing and then ended up being charged with a drug crime.
One of the things that we recently had a ruling on is Judge Grieve ruled that Mr. Liggins' prior bad acts cannot be admitted into evidence in this current case. This trial is coming up. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of prior bad acts there. I mean, this is somebody who served 7 years in prison in Mississippi for armed robbery. This is somebody who, a month before Jennifer died, was arrested and charged with sexually abusing another 9-year-old girl. In that particular case, he was later convicted of it. We also know that, you know, he stood trial for a prison stabbing in Mississippi and was eventually acquitted. We know there's some other allegations that have been out there. But none of that stuff is going to come into put before the jury unless perhaps Mr. Liggins's were to testify and they would use that to impeach him. But for all intents and purposes, short of that, it almost is certain not to be admitted. And one of the questions that comes to mind is, should, now we're talking about a should, not will sort of situation, should prior bad acts be something that jurors should be able to consider in the grand scheme of things? Michael, what are your thoughts there?
At sentencing, I believe, yes. Not at the trial itself. You don't want it just be clear prejudice, and you'd never get the conviction upheld. But I do believe at sentencing, the juror should be appraised of a criminal's record, because I think it helps make that judgment as to whether or not they're dealing with somebody who really needs to get the longer term in the range. And the priors tell you that this is a defendant who, when he's out, is committing crimes. So, yeah, I think that's where you'd want to have it come in. But no, it's always going to be prejudicial to introduce it to the jury in a guilt trial, because people will make their judgments based on those priors. And they've got it. The facts have to bear out the guilt or innocence of the defendant. I'm agreeing with you on that, I think the priors do matter, especially at sentencing.
Unfortunately, folks, Michael just had to leave the interview because an emergency came up in his office. But we're going to pose this question to Lauren and to Kathleen on the death penalty. We should pretty well guess where Michael falls on this, because his group is one of the leading advocates for the capital punishment in the United States. One of the things that comes to mind, too, is when this case happened 27 years ago, the governor of Iowa back then, who's still the governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, said this was an example of why Iowa needed to reinstate the death penalty. Iowa hasn't had the death penalty for quite a long time. There's a variety of reasons. I think much of it has to do with the religious makeup of the state and some other things. But I guess the question is, I was going to ask this question to Michael because he's obviously from an organization that's a very strong proponent of the death penalty, but does that sort of proposal make sense to you, Kathleen?
I don't think so. I'm very strongly opposed to the death penalty in all situations, and I think particularly in a case like this where something so horrible happened to a little girl, I think emotions would probably be running a little too high. And I think that somebody who is accused of something like that would be more likely to end up with a death penalty that wasn't necessarily warranted. But again, I oppose it in all situations.
How about you, Lauren?
I mean, I think this case is exactly why there shouldn't be a death penalty. It's come back twice now. It's going to go to its third trial for different errors. And it could be very well be a wrongful conviction. And had the death penalty been in place, Stanley Liggins might already have been executed. That's the horrifying reality of the death penalty. I, too, am very against the death penalty. There are studies on the death penalty. A 2014 study conservatively estimated that 4.1% of death row inmates are innocent. So that would mean 118 people currently on death row. And that's so many people that could be put to death for something that they didn't do. And I think that if one person is put to death for something they didn't do, that's far too many and is not something that we as Americans should be okay with. I mean, most people know that we are not in very good company at this point for countries that still implement the death penalty. Of more advanced countries, first world countries, there are very, very few, you know, China, North Korea, those types of countries. And we are just very, very behind in our views on the death penalty. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. I mean, it was only in 2005 that the U.S. Supreme Court determined that you can't execute juveniles or when they were juveniles at the time of the crime, which is shocking if you think about it. That's only 12 years ago that we were potentially executing children. at the time. And as we know, their brains have a lot longer to go until they're fully developed. They say about 26 years old, and they're so reliant on family members and around them. They're susceptible to peer pressure, and they don't fully know right from wrong at that point. And the Supreme Court has been slowly improving the case law regarding the death penalty and juvenile issues in general. Even as they say, mentally retarded defendants were still being put to death until 2002. And in my opinion, it's just a hypocritical idea that we say that it's so wrong to kill people that to prove our point and to show you how wrong you were, we're going to kill you. It just doesn't make sense logically to me. And studies also show that it doesn't actually serve as a deterrent. And that's the big idea of, well, any sort of criminal conviction, any sort of sentence is supposed to serve as punishment, a deterrent to others, rehabilitation. Obviously, the death penalty is not serving as rehabilitation. So I just don't think that it has any function in our society to date. And also because of all of the wrongful convictions that we've seen and errors that we've seen from cases of people who are on death row or that have already been convicted. Cameron Willingham is one that comes to mind with the arson in Texas, that modern arson science shows that that was not an arson. It was an accidental fire. And I just think that that is far too tragic for us to allow to continue to happen.
Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. A big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.